we were working yesterday on these three simple facts. And I want to reiterate kind of what I said yesterday. I really think there's a time and place to go into really technical things at a deep level. And when you've got somebody that has, you know, a background in science or molecular biology or something and talks about that, it's just astounding what's there. But what I'm going to recommend is looking at things that are obvious people can see with their naked eye. Because when Romans 1 was written, it's saying that the Gentiles can see the power of God. He wasn't saying the biochemists can see the power of God. He wasn't saying the people with PhDs can see the power of God. It's just out there. And again, sometimes when you read stuff like the chances of life happening, you know, by chance are one to so many zeros and zeros, that sounds really impressive, but if you tell somebody that,
you take enough years, maybe it can happen.
And who says that you didn't run the math, you read that somewhere, and people can do all sorts of things with statistics like this one. What were the chances that Jesus would fulfill all of the prophecies in Scripture? Have you ever heard the numbers on that?
Or in Texas.
And it's like, you know what? Well, let's say he was born in Bethlehem. Well, only certain, I don't know how they run the numbers, but let me just illustrate something here. How many of you were born in Bethlehem? So you see, only a small number of people were born in Bethlehem. But everybody born in Bethlehem was born in Bethlehem. Okay. How many of you are descendants of Abraham? But everybody that's descendants of Abraham was a descendant of Abraham. And what are the chances of a crucified dead man coming out of a tomb 3 days later?
1 in 0.
Yeah. Your number of how many chances out of how many quarters you find in Texas is out the window at this point, because that just doesn't happen, you know, naturally. So some of those arguments, I think, are flawed sometimes. And some of them, you're asking people to trust something you read. And sometimes they'll come, and if they hear somebody with a science background, if they find one detail, well, actually, that's not the way that polymer works or something. So what I would recommend for most conversations, there is a place for that, but for most conversations, go into things that people can just see. Okay? Start there. If you want to proceed farther and say, hey, check out this video on this, great, after the conversation started. But start with something they can see where they're not trusting your word for. Does that make sense? All right, so three simple facts. Say them with me again. Nothing comes from nothing. Life comes from life. Intelligent design comes from intelligent designer. So if nothing comes from nothing, then when was there nothing?
Never.
So there's always been something. And it can't be dead, non-living, and it needs to be intelligent. Do you see that you've already sketched an outline of the Creator right there? All right. So, and of course, our been listening to Gardner. Sorry to say our poop tanks. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what is made. And yes, the more we look into it, in Darwin's day they thought a cell was a luminous blob. It's beyond anything in machine we've made. You can see it more and more, but we're going to stay at a simpler level. So that brings us back to the bird's nest in Job 39. Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? Now, we started talking about different kinds of nests. We talked about this yesterday, right? All right. So in other words, there's floating nests, platform nests, burrow nests, mound nests, ground nests, cup nests, dome nests, platform nests, hanging nests, adherent nests, etc., etc., etc. That's a cup nest. Did we go through any of these pictures yesterday?
Yep.
Very good.
All right, right at the end. Okay, so it's like, imagine you're gonna get married and you're telling your wife, you know, she says, where are we gonna live? You know, place to raise the babies. I'm going to stick some mud on the side of the wall and we'll put the babies in the mud. Does that sound like a very... No, no. And by the way, you got to do this with no hands. Okay? So that's an adherent nest. This is a pendant nest. That's pretty cool. This is a tiny nest. That's a hummingbird nest. This is a big nest. That's a stork nest. And there are nests. We did mention this one, right? A nest made out of saliva. You're going to see more about that in a minute. There are sewn nests made by the tailor bird. We'll see more about this in a minute. There are elastic nests that expand because they'll have up to 15 babies in there that are going to be getting bigger. And, of course, cup nests. Now, this is kind of fascinating. So this is xchristian.net. So these are people that used to be in a denominational, you know, wider sense. They used to believe in Jesus, and now they don't anymore. And this is where they talk. And one of them has this question. Where does nest-building instinct come from? Watch this. Many of us know that a lot of things we used to believe were instinct are actually information transfer. Bird songs, bird migrations, dam building in beavers, so forth. However, here's a question that stumps me. And if a Christian asks it, I'd love to have an answer. Nest building. How is the information transferred from parent to offspring? Think about that for a second. How old is that robin going to be when it leaves the nest in your backyard?
Very young.
About 2 weeks old. And then what's it going to do?
Go off on its own.
And build a nest. Because it remembers how it saw its parents build a nest. You see the problem? Everybody see that? So he's saying, this stumps me. Yeah, it should. Baby birds learn a few things from their parents: flight, foraging, danger avoidance, grooming, etc. Even songs are passed on from father to son in many species. And quite a few migratory birds, the offspring migrate with the flock. Parents are members of the first year, many not all. All these at one time were thought to be instinct. Now we know it's parent-offspring transfer of information. Nest building is another matter. Birds build and repair nests before the eggs are laid. And when the offspring leave the nest, they don't return to it. In other words, they never observe their parents building a nest. I guess information transfer is easier to conceive of than instinct for something as structurally complex as a bird's nest. It's not like an anthill or beehive built in modules. You either get it right or you get disaster. So if we're a bunch of ants in like natural selection, well, we can't figure out how to build an anthill. You know, anteater, we're just wandering around, anteater gets us, you know, we don't survive, our gene pool doesn't go. And the ones that figured out how to build an anthill, but it's like I'm bringing my grain of sand and Sean dumps his over there. It's like, what are you doing, man? Put it over here. Big deal. It's a mound, right? The bird's nest, that's kind of altogether different. You're the cage swiftlet spitting on the wall. It needs to work, right? It's 100 feet up, 200 feet up in a cave. If it doesn't work, what's going to happen to the eggs? Yeah, they're out of the gene pool real quick. And, of course, they would say, oh, so see natural selection. If you're not good at building a nest, you don't make it. There's a place for natural selection, you know. But survival of the fittest doesn't explain the arrival of the fittest. How do they know to do it? Yes, there's plenty of bird nests of all shapes, sizes, locations, including burrows that resemble something a reptile would use, because they believe birds came from. I think the graduation of nest building technology is not difficult to explain, but parent to offspring transfer seems to be. I've never read anything that discusses where in the DNA so-called instincts like this get stored. This just looks like something that should be the result of an information transfer of some sort. If you're a robin born in the nest, how would you even know that your parents built it? You know, were you born you grew up in your parents' house? That doesn't mean your dad built it. You know, it's like, how do they know? Anyway, grateful for any response. Can you see why he's perplexed?
Yeah.
Somebody responded. Richard Dawkins had an article a couple years ago that addresses that subject. New studies found birds learn the art of nest building rather than being just an instinctive skill. Okay, and there's the link. He reads it. Interesting article. They don't address how they first learned about nest building, though. Because it's like, okay, thanks. And it's from Edinburgh. Oh, and by the way, after that, this topic is now closed to further replies. Nobody gave him an answer. A robin will leave the nest when they're about 13 days old. 24 hours later, the nest will be empty. Here's that study from Scotland. New study says birds learn how to build nests. New studies found birds learn the art of nest building rather than being just an instinctive skill. It's from the University of Edinburgh. And they say some things here, like some bird weaver birds are studying that do a pendant nest. Some build right to left, some build left to right. And in their studies, they saw that as a bird builds nest after nest after nest, he gets better at it, so he drops the blade of grass less often.
Doesn't explain how
I
learned in the first place.
Right! Which, notice this word here. See, this study is not about saying it's not instinct. They're saying it's not just instinct. Do you suppose, you know, if you were a bird and you've got the, do you suppose that after you build a few nests you might get better at it? Yes, that doesn't explain the thing to begin with, which is why this fellow, oh, Dawkins posted an article about that. He goes, yeah, that was interesting, but, yeah, you see. All right, let's get back, take a closer look at some of those nests. The cave swiftlet. This is him. This is where he lives, Southeast Asia. Lives in dark caves, sometimes back where there's no light, and he uses echolocation. Makes clicking sounds as he flies. There's a bunch of them flying through there. And sometimes there will be a predator, like a python or something. If there's a bunch, one near the cave entrance, then a bunch of them will fly in real quick at once, kind of for protection. And they'll go back and they're flying around in the dark. And he builds his wall doing spit. And by the way, remember, do you think you could make some of these bird nests very well? No. How about do it without hands? Okay, now he's going to spit on this cave wall, 100 feet up, and build a nest. And then this is what, and it turns into soup, that's what the nests look like. That's a picture of up in the cave, okay? Here's the ladder, and I've seen a picture of these guys, but I didn't have, they were copyrighted, I didn't have permission on using those, so I use this one. But some of the ones, I mean, you'll see a guy, the ladder be going way up here, and the guy's like this big or so climbing up the ladder. I mean, he's way, way up there, maybe 100 feet off the ground, going up there to harvest these bird nests and stuff. And a lot of them will be on a wall where it's even sloping like this. The weaver bird, okay, makes a pendant hanging nest. This is kind of, okay, you get the idea, but this? There he is, building the nest. Again, say it, without hands, yeah. Check this out, a baya weaver. This one's partially constructed, and here you see the tunnel there coming down like that. Look at these things, they're fantastic.
I guess it's like they don't do without glue, too. Like,
yeah. And it's like, you know, if your wife says, hey, we need a place to live, I'm going to start hanging some grass from the end of a stick, you know. This is a Montezuma or a Pindolis from Costa Rica, if I remember correctly. There he is, flying through. See what he's got? And that's what they build. This is a tailor bird. He sews. See the rivets here? He's poked holes in that and put rivets. There you can see the rivets, and there you can see down inside there. That's amazing. This is a long-tailed tit. He builds an elastic nest. It's built out of lichen, moss, and spider webs. He will line the inside with it, or see, I don't remember which it is, with 1,500 to 2,000 feathers.
Wow.
Now, these are also kind of communal birds. If there's like a single bird out there or an old mate bird, they'll stick around and maybe help out with some of the other birds. But 1,500 or more feathers inside to line it, which of course would give some insulation. They'll lay 8 to 10 or even up to 15 eggs in there, which is why you're going to need that elasticity. In their effort to collect all various materials, they fly between 600 and 700 miles to build that nest. Stretchable nest accommodates large brood of growing chicks. This is the hummingbird. Notice also some spider webbing in that. And did we talk about the hummingbird in this class already?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to skip this stuff. And now we're going to talk about something else that flies, the honeybee. Who knows what a waggle dance is?
Well, just one question. Why would it be an issue or cause any consternation for the birds to build nests by instinct?
Just, he's saying, how would you, in your DNA, how would, it's just so complex. That's what's kind of boggling him. It's like, some things are pretty simple, but something as complex as nest building, he's just kind of boggled how that would just be instinct. Because again, if you're an atheist, we're all just random chemicals, you know, and some started living, and then some were better suited to their environment, and then there's some mutations, and it provided some variation, and that like this. But this is a pretty complex behavior, and so that boggles me. So the waggle, oh, and by the way, there is some genetics going on there. Certainly, I'm sure they learned some things, but like there was some crossbreeding of some different, was it pigeons or something else? And like some tended to carry something under the wing and some would carry it in a beak or foot or something. But when they did some hybridization crossbreeding, they would turn their head to like to reach for here, even though there wasn't something there. So there's something genetic going on. All right, the waggle dance. Who knows what the waggle dance is? Explain it.
It's a way that bees can communicate to the rest of the hive where they found food, pollen, whatever.
Yeah, and I saw a video years ago of where the scientists go in the hive, they put like dots of paint on the back of the bee to make sure they know what bee's doing what. And it's like, this bee will find some pollen, and then he will fly back to the hive, and he will do a dance while the other bees watch that tell them where the pollen is. And just recently, I read a couple weeks ago, you can take a bee from America and put it in a hive of European bees, and the honeybees in Europe will be able to understand the dance of the American bee. And here's how it works. In position of the sun, if here's the hive and there's the sun and there's the source of nectar, he will do an angle that is this angle. And then the amount of time that he waggles is telling the other bees how far to go in that direction. He'll waggle, come around here, waggle, come around here, waggle, come around there, while the other bees are sitting there watching, and then they'll go and find it. So here's going to be our waggle bee, and there he goes, and these other bees are like, okay, you know, it's happening. He'll do it several times until they got, okay, it's over there, and that's how far it is, in that angle from the sun, and bzzz, off they go.
Wow.
Okay? And you pull up a video, and you can watch this, it goes around, and the other bees are watching. Amazing. Speaking of bugs, this is an archerfish. Who knows what an archerfish is? Tell me about an archerfish.
They come to the water surface, spit water out the mouth. And
that's why they're called archerfishes. Now, a bug can hold on to things tight. They can do 10 times their body weight in holding on to things. All right. So, like, have you ever been driving, you get in your car, and there's a grasshopper on the windshield? You've seen this happen, right? And you start driving. Now, if I'm driving down the road, how many of you want to grip my windshield as I'm going down the road? Now, I'll get the antenna or something, give me a windshield wiper, but they'll, and have you seen, they hang on there, right? And they're hanging on, finally you hit a speed. No! Yeah, but it takes a while before the wind force can take it out of there. Well, this little dude, so he's down here in the river, they're like in South America, and here's some bushes and reeds and stuff hanging over the bank. And there's some bugs or beetles crawling on them. He can, from several feet away, shoot down that bug. Hits it with a burst of water powerful enough. Now, if you watch videos, it not always falls on the first try. The bug might be on top, and bam, here comes the water. And then hits him again, bam, and then he's here, bam, and then boom, he falls into the water, lunch. Okay? So, this is the archer fish.
And they actually calculate for the refraction of light.
Yes!
Amazing.
Have you ever noticed when you look at an aquarium, right? And it's like there's a goldfish in there. And where's the goldfish? Well, it's right there. But then you notice from the top, wait! There's another goldfish exactly like that one swimming the same direction. It's over there. It's because of the way the light works on the angles and stuff, it throws it off. This fish, he's able to handle that. His eyes are below the water, and he can handle that and still hit it. By the way, PLOS One, I think this is Public Library Online Science or something. Interesting site. These video, the little video I'm about to show you, for instance, it's free to use by anybody, no copyright restrictions and stuff. It's a helpful site. How the archer fish achieves a powerful impact. Hydrodynamic instability of a pulse jet. They have found out, they don't understand, they can't figure out everything about him, and given time, they'll figure out more. But what he sends up gets more powerful as it goes.
Whoa.
Didn't say faster, but more powerful. Because the mass is going to accumulate like this so that it's hitting him stronger at the top. Would you like to watch him? Boom. Now, that is not a bug up there. This is where they're studying the thing. And this is in slow motion, by the way. So this is a piece of tape that they take the little bug to. I think they take the bug to it. And so it's not going to fall. They're just studying the projection. So this is slow motion. Cruel. Let's watch it again. Let's watch it one more time. Well, here it is. All right. So there's all kinds of sciences. This, they're studying how this stream of water, you know, gets like this hip. Bam! And so, once they spot their prey, they shoot it down by squirting a precisely aimed jet of water out of their mouth. So the prey falls into the water, it's devoured. Preys are usually firmer anchored to vegetation, anchor forces typically being an order of 10 times their body weight. The origin of the effectiveness of the predation mechanism has long been debated. The problem of the origin of the effectiveness of the jet remains unsolved. The velocity of the jet of the mouthfish is modulated so to achieve a gradual increase by mass accumulated at the head of the jet and its velocity. As a result, the power that the head can deliver on impact increases during the shooting. And they can hit something several feet away.
So it's like getting hit by a railroad train. You know, you got that long line of cars, the masses,
But it's like the railroad train, it's like the caboose is catching up to the other, so it's like bam. And so they're doing all this study on this and everything. They can't figure out all how it's done. That doesn't mean that there's an angel in there doing it. You know, sooner or later, they try to find the muscles. You know, they haven't figured it all out. But the fact is, this is just pretty awesome. And if they look more, they should find more explanations of how he's doing it. But who thought of that? That little fish is like, hey man, if I do some algebra, and yeah, this is not, you know, where did this come from? PLOS, by the way, they use Creative Commons. It's unrestricted use, available for use without permission for virtually any purpose. So just for science, that's an interesting website. Let's watch him again one more time. Bam! It's just awesome. Now here's my question. How would that gradually evolve?
Starved to death before it evolved.
I mean, like, if I tried to explain evolution or why rabbits have big ears, you know, well, maybe long ago, rabbits had smaller ears, and so you could not hear as well, so more often you'd get eaten by a predator and stuff, but then one's born, he's got a little bit longer ears, so now he's got a natural advantage. So natural selection, here comes the fox. And You know, so we see how that works. And so, you know, they're going to get longer and longer ears. You see how that could play out, you know, with the evolution argument there. How would you do that? What survival advantage would step one produce? Who was it? Bugs up there.
Fish spit at me.
It's like, feel something moist. How? How is that a gradual advantage?
Alright, sorry. Does the fish also use that as a defense mechanism?
No.
Oh.
I mean, not that I know of, because I mean, another fish might eat him. Him being spitting out of the water is probably not going to help there.
Nobody gets like fisherman or a guy in a boat or just shoot him. He's terrified of like fish.
Water being spit on you with the size you are is probably, if you're going, oh, ow, ow, you know, you've got bigger issues than that. But this is huge for him to get his food. Alright, but what on earth, what survival, and are we really telling, well, maybe just one fish got this mutation, he's like, yo, I'm X-Fish, watch this, bam! No! By the way, this whole thing of building variations on mutations, listen, I got a mutation, Jeff does too, we're colorblind. It didn't give us superpowers. You know, it's like, you know, when you go to the hospital and the baby's born and says, your baby's born... he's a mutant. Most parents don't go, yay! What superpower does he have? It's something's messed up. All right. The mimic octopus. How many of you know about the mimic octopus? How many minutes do we have?
Enough.
17. Oh, super, super, super. All right. The mimic octopus. Can you see him there?
No.
Now watch this.
Cool.
Great. Octopuses are amazing. I was getting some tires done. I was at the tire place the other day, and I'm watching on the TV. They've got an octopus in like a mayonnaise jar.
Yep.
With a screw-on lid.
Oh, yeah.
He's unscrewing the lid. And gets out. One time, and earlier in this video, there was a lab, and the fish keep disappearing over there. You know, they put up a security camera, and at night, the octopus from over here is like, it's amazing. And so one of the things I like about these things is talk to your friends about these. You know, share something like this with them. There's room to go deeper, but it's just looking at right off at just some of the things in God's creation that he put here to impress us. It's like, let your friends be impressed with it. Think about it. All right, here we go. Wrong video.
Scott, they found out recently they were observing.
Oh, there we go. That was for a different. That was a follow-up video from a different thing. All right, everybody ready? Get ready to be impressed. Some of you already know about this. Some of these octopuses. This one isn't necessary. I think this is mimic octopus, but the next one is for sure. But this is definitely an octopus.
Dress of disguise. They can change their entire skin color and texture in under a second to match their surroundings. Octopuses match their body texture to their environment using octane and can kill a human in under 90 minutes. Though there have only been three fatalities.
I'm backing up. I'm backing up. All right, now listen. Listen closely.
Octopuses are masters of disguise. They can change their entire skin color and texture in under a second to match their surroundings. Octopuses match their body texture to their environment using eyesight. But the mystifying thing is, they're colorblind. They may be able to distinguish polarized light better than humans can, but how they actually tell different colors apart is still unknown. Their color change is made possible by cells called chromatophores, which contain different pigments. Fox Meyer from the Smithsonian Museum describes the color-changing process as similar to squeezing a dye-filled balloon. The more you squeeze, the more the surface is stretched, and the more the color appears. They're also able to change texture, creating bumps, spikes, grooves, and ripples as needed. Not just colors.
Yep. Watch that again.
What?
Hold up.
The process is similar to squeezing a dye-filled balloon. The more you squeeze, the more the surface is stretched, and the more the color appears. They're also able to change texture, creating bumps, spikes, grooves, and ripples as needed.
There's another video where you can watch the octopus go to a spot of black coral, and he's going along, and he goes down to it and instantly changes texture and color, blending in with it.
Similar to squeezing a dye-filled balloon. The more you squeeze, the more the surface is stretched, and the more the color appears. They're also able to change texture, creating bumps, spikes, grooves, and ripples as needed. It's not just color and texture. Some octopuses, namely the mimic octopus, not only imitates color and texture, but shape and behavior. The open ocean is a deadly place for octopuses, so instead of adapting deadly poison or sharp teeth, they've adapted to be able to look like things that have deadly poison or sharp teeth. In under a second, a mimic octopus can change their color, pull their arms back, and swim along the ocean floor to resemble a banded sole. Or they'll swim in more open water with a stripy pattern, with their arms jutted out to resemble the spines and movement of the deadly lionfish. If they're under attack, they'll bury all but two arms underground and put on a stripe pattern to...
Here's a little bit more about the mimic octopus. So that's Octopus is the World's Greatest Escape Artist on YouTube. And this is Most Intelligent Mimic Octopus in the World. Here we go. Ready?
Unknown until it was spotted, first by fishermen off the coast of Indonesia in the 1990s. It looked like an octopus, but it could morph its shape in an instant to appear as seemingly any animal around it. At first, no one had any idea what it was.
The first time I saw it, I just was blown away. You couldn't get a more spectacular animal. It really is the pinnacle of wizardry.
Biologist Mark Norman was the first scientist to study this seemingly shapeless creature. He named it the mimic octopus.
The mimic octopus makes itself look like a living, moving animal, so it pulls all of its arms around behind its body and swims along like a poisonous flatfish called a banded sole. In other cases, if it's getting attacked, it puts six arms down a hole and raises the other two arms to look like a poisonous sea snake that has bands along its body. That's not enough. It'll swim along looking like a poisonous lionfish with these banded arms looking like the banded spines that come off these very deadly fish.
So far, 15 separate species are known to be in the mimic octopus act, and Norman is not always sure exactly what the mimic is doing. Looking something like a furry turkey.
Sometimes it's hard when you watch a mimic octopus doing what it does to interpret what's going on. It's a bit like looking at ink spots in a psychiatrist's office going, I don't know what that is, your fridge. So you get three or four divers together and you'll argue all night trying to work out what we think it was mimicking.
Where did nature's greatest actor come from?
Good question. All right. Let's get back here and finish up. So,
Grammarly does more than catch things. With Grammarly, you can find out. No.
JD sent me this the other day, and this is from 3 years ago, University of Southampton, Science Daily. Is evolution more intelligent than we thought? Think of all the times you've read and heard about people mocking intelligent design. Remember when people tried to get intelligent design to be taught in schools, and they're like, response to this. Is evolution more intelligent than we thought? For University of Southampton. Evolution may be more intelligent than we thought, according to researchers. In a new article, the authors make the case that evolution is able to learn from previous experience, which could promote a better explanation of how evolution by natural selection produces such apparently intelligent designs. When we look at the amazing, apparently intelligent designs that evolution produces, it takes some imagination to understand how random variation and selection produce them. But then they go, but if you have enough variation in natural selection, we can get that. But then it says, if evolution can learn from experience and thus improve on its own ability to evolve over time, this can... We need to be pointing at nature and letting people be mystified. You know, you remember the girl talking about the octopus? It's mystifying to try to explain the design in nature without a designer is pretty mystifying. So they're saying this can demystify the awesomeness of the
design.
That
evolution.
So evolution is now a designer? Natural selection can accumulate knowledge that enables it to evolve smarter. That's exciting because it explains why biological design appears to be so intelligent. Let's just say this real quick. So if Darwinian evolution has said it's natural selection, no intelligent design. You've seen that mocked in papers. All this intelligent design stuff. And if somebody says, no, God designed everything intelligent, there's no natural selection at all. Well, if you read Darwin's book, a lot of it makes sense. I've got one picture of some birds in a nest, and, you know, some of the birds are up here, and then one bird down here. You know, if somebody doesn't make it, I'm betting it's this guy. I mean, you know, if you're a slow bunny, out of the gene pool, you know. And so, but natural selection would seem to work better on if you come up short of the genetic pattern, you know, rather than like X-Men bunny suddenly being born. Because it's mutations mean there's something's missing, generally speaking. Occasionally, in certain environments, it can be advantageous, like the wingless beetles on an island near the Canary Islands, where it's a windy island. It's a small island. If beetles are flying around and a gust of wind comes, and it doesn't have to be an archer fish, because sooner or later you're getting tired, you hit the water, and so it's wingless beetles that survive there. But notice, that's not new information, it's a loss of information. How many of you have a car with over 100,000 miles on it? Does anything quit working?
Yeah.
What's quit working?
Air conditioning.
Yeah. It's not like, hey, I drove this car to 100,000 miles, suddenly it's got radar. No, that's not how it works. Things can go out. So you can have natural selection, but that doesn't change that there's intelligent design. So, back to this. Say it with me. Just remember these three points.
Nothing comes from nothing. Life comes from life. Intelligent design comes from an intelligent designer.
Are we done, or do we have time for discussion?
You've got about 5 minutes.
All right. Comments, thoughts, questions.
Scott.
Great. The article that you just posted up there, where do they think this knowledge is being stored? I mean, natural selection is not a...
It's on the web.
That it's somehow stored in the genes? Or?
I haven't read the whole article.
Okay.
J.D. gave me that quip the other day. I was doing this over there in Columbus. And at lunch, he told me about it. And so I haven't read the whole thing. But it's just so interesting that after mocking intelligent design, they're starting to talk about the idea of evolution designing and having an intelligence.
Yeah,
this whole idea, it just reinforces what's said in Romans about professing to be wise, they become fools. Because they do all this mental gymnastics to try to prove it takes an imagination. Yes, it does. I can't even admit it. That's, wow.
Yeah.
I also think it's funny because the more and more the language almost seems to make evolution a type of creative being.
Yes. Like, yes. Sound like yes. God. When you hear them talking about like evolution, it's almost in the earth, and you'll hear people talk about the earth is now like rebelling against the way that we have abused it and stuff. Evolution is really a little bit like some pagan theologies, you know, Mother Earth and life coming from the water. Like there were some Greeks who believed that life was formed in the ocean and things washed up on shore, and sometimes in a bad combination, like, you know, a bull body with a human head or a body with three heads or different thing, or a leg and a arm or something, and then eventually something washed up right, you know, which is, and of course you look at that, what? But that's just a macroscopic description of what they're saying happened microscopically, that some, you know, proteins and different something around and stuff. So it's kind of interesting.
So I feel like I can present this, I can talk about this. What about when somebody knows way more about this kind of stuff than I do, and it's beyond my ability to talk to them about it? What's your suggestion?
Like, for instance, if they say, all of this can be explained by natural selection. And here's the idea, the evolutionary argument, and it's in Darwin. We've got some slides on this, but I'll try to sum it up kind of briefly. There's variation in... Darwin started with natural selection, I mean artificial selection, on the farm. Is that 5 minutes or what?
No, I've got
it. All right, how many minutes do we have?
Two.
Okay. Darwin's Origin of the Species is that. It's about origin of the species, which is phenomenally arbitrary, the way they define species. I mean, how many of you, what's the scientific name for dog?
Canis.
If you're my age, you were taught familiaris.
Canis familiaris.
1993, they changed it. Now it's Canis lupus, which is the same thing as a wolf, because they came from wolves, and they can reproduce with wolves. A German Shepherd and a wolf, you know, can reproduce, but they still say coyote is a different species, even though coyotes can reproduce with dogs and with wolves. The red wolf in Canada is part coyote, part wolf and stuff. So it gets very arbitrary, but Darwin, the world he came from, every species was independently created. And so like you got tons of rattlesnake species, a number of rattlesnake species just in California. You know, so if you believe, and more than anything else, you know what most species are, proportionately? Bugs. Endless species of bugs, you know, because you find a beetle and et cetera. But Darwin's idea is this. On the farm, you got artificial selection, where the farmer chooses which one are you going to breed, the runt pig or that prize bull. You know, you're going to keep breeding the best to get what you want. That's why we have chickens that have a lot of breast meat on them. A Libby has some old line chickens. They don't have that much meat on them, and they can fly a lot better. You know, we breed things to get certain things. So he said, if you can do that on the farm, nature can do that out in the jungle or in the woods. And so the principles are this. There is variation in life. Look around this room. Does everybody? Who in this room would be best built for pole vaulting? Who in this room would be best built to be a linebacker? I'm saying Winston, you know, of us. He's built better to be a linebacker. Who's best in this room to be our jump hurdles? You know, there's variations, okay? And so you have variation, and then there's pressure. Not everything is going to survive. If every fly that was born from every maggot was alive, it'd be Egypt all the time. If every mouse that was ever born, if none of them were eaten by hawks or anything else or killed by people, there'd be mice everywhere. Most things that are born are not all going to survive. So there's famine, there's predators, there's disease, there's death. And so it keeps eliminating. So there's a pressure for survival. So if there's variation and there's pressure for survival, who's more likely to survive? The ones that are best fit in that environment. So nature cleans out the bottom of the gene pool, and these survive. And then later, after Darwin, they get to neo-Darwinism that says, okay, the mechanism is mutations. That's what provides your variation. The problem there is mutations are...
awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So let's use a computer game analogy. Gary, you remember when we were teenagers and there was Atari? So here was the computer game. There was a white thing here and a dot. Boom. Boom. Anybody ever play that game?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, two colors. You know, it is. All right, and it had an airplane version. You could fly a little, like, maybe 16-pixel little World War I airplane. And it's, you know, just flat and everything else. Now, what kind of computer game can you have of World War I? I mean, you can do all sorts of things, see all sorts of views, have a backstory and everything. Do you think that happened because the original Atari thing, somebody put a magnet on it? And it altered the inside that now you can look out the back, you know, and then, you know, somebody left it in the sun and now it's got a bunch of colors. And then, when you mess up the computer coding, does it make it better or worse? It might be neutral and it's like your car, you know, something happens to it, it doesn't affect it. Something happens to it, makes it worse. You know, you hit a pothole. It usually, hey, it doesn't miss anymore. You know, that's not how things generally work. But that's the idea of his theory. All right, our time is up, and we'll get back to another topic tomorrow. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Scott. Hey, Scott.
Yep.
One thing that you might find interesting. There's a picture on the internet that you